for Ballon Designs.
Yeah, I think you told us he sells some pretty high quality Ballon structures with real good Balloning material. So Ballon Designs looks like a good place to go. Maybe that's what you're looking for, Paul. Go ahead, Paul.
I actually came across them when I was looking into the whole Ballon thing. I ended up buying, I think, a number 43 core. It's like 2.4 inches. And I'm not sure what I'm going to do in terms of winding it. I'm probably either going to do bifilar windings or just run some 58, RG58 through there. I'm in the process. It's raining today, so I couldn't go up on the roof and put it there. But I'm trying to build a new doublet because previously all I've been using for HF is a little 20-meter dipole about 10 feet off the ground. And I'm putting a big, basically an inverted V doublet up in a tree. And I was just kind of looking into different kinds of Ballon designs because, you know, fed with that line, you don't want all that RF in the shack.
Yeah, lateral line is what is feeding your dipole, is what I think you're saying. And now the proper way of launching from the coax out of the transmitter into the lateral line is what we're discussing. And one of the ways of one band at a time. Are you familiar with a half-wave coax Ballon? That's where you take a half wavelength of any kind of coax, any impedance, and fold it back on itself into a U-shape and connect the shields together. And then the center conductor, the two center conductors are the balanced output. One of the center conductors is going to be fed by your coax cable coming from the transmitter. That half-wave coax Ballon structure is a 4-to-1 impedance device. So it will give you 200 ohm output. And in some cases on lateral line, 200 ohm feed impedance is pretty close to what you need. So there you wouldn't need any ferrite at all, one band at a time. You're probably familiar with that one, Paul. KD2, Kilo Delta Golf, KQIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, you got the call right. For the different, I was planning on using it for multiband just because I don't really have the room. I'm in Baldwin Harbor, but I don't really have the room to set up, you know, a bunch of different antennas, so I'm trying to use it. It's kind of like a G5RV, but I tried doing some stuff in 4NEC2 and simulations and stuff, and I mean, even with the other multiband dipoles like the G5RV, whatever impedance is coming out of that laninine is not going to match my, I have a tuner, it's not going to match the coax whatsoever, so I'm not really probably going to be doing a 4-to-1. From what I've seen, I think 1-to-1 current is kind of what I want, because I'm not really aiming to transform the impedance. I'm just trying to chop out, you know, the common mode stuff that's going to fry my speakers.
Over. KD2KDG.
Yeah, with a 1-to-1, you might still end up with a 3 or 4-to-1 standing wave ratio, because lateral line... Oh, wait a minute now. Your dipole itself is around 70 ohms. You're feeding it with a 200, 300, 400 ohm lateral line. So there is an impedance mismatch right there. And if your lateral line is the right number of wavelength long, it will repeat the impedance of your antenna, or it can give you an inversion. So even though the lateral line might be running at a fairly high standing wave ratio, it can tolerate it because it's a very low loss line when being fed correctly. So I guess I agree with you. The balancing function is your highest priority. The right impedance match is a secondary priority. And so as you do these experiments, let us know how it works out. I'm back to you on that call, K2IW. Repeat that last statement you made, Paul, so we can hear it. KD2, KDG, KQ. KD2LIW.
Sorry about that. What I'm saying is, if you have the ladder line, an odd multiple of 1/8 of a wavelength, it'll kind of just act as an impedance transformer, and it'll knock out crazy impedances like 10,000 ohms or something. It'll knock it down to like maybe 300 or so, something that a tuner can handle. And just throwing wire up in a tree with a drone, actually, I can talk about that. Drones are pretty good for it. I was able to get it to tune on every band except for 80 meters and 10 meters, and that was without adjusting the length of anything or just trimming it or anything. So I think if I trim that ladder line down to the right length for what's going on, I could probably get it to tune on all the bands. And being 40 feet up in the air, I'd actually be able to get on some of the lower ham bands that I couldn't get on previously. Back to you.
That does sound like a pretty good approach, because the ladder line, even if it does run on a fairly high standing wave ratio, it can tolerate it. And with the right kind of an antenna tuner, the transmitter can tolerate it. So overall, the right kind of balancing function, so that you're feeding your ladder line in a balanced manner, like we said before, that's your highest priority. And the exact impedance match is a little bit more academic. But various ways of adjusting the length of the ladder line can give you all kinds of adjustments of impedance. An odd number of quarter wavelengths gives you an inversion. An even number of quarter wavelengths gives you same input impedance and output impedance. The eighth of a wave that you mentioned as a way of canceling reactants, I'm a little bit skeptical on that one. Under certain circumstances, maybe. A particular impedance, maybe. But eighth wave, I don't think it's going to give you an inversion. I know it's not. It's not going to give you equal impedance in and out. It's going to give you some other kind of a crazy combination. Where did you find out about this eighth of a wave impedance canceling characteristic, Paul? KDG, K2LIW in the TechNet?
Well, I did a bunch of research on stuff online, and basically I'm just looking for like
antennas
that I can build myself, because you know, I'm still in high school, I'm not going to be spending big money on, you know, antennas and stuff. But basically what it came down to is probably going to be some kind of, you know, ladder line fed dipole. And there's this website on my computer, I can look it up, it's in my history somewhere, but it was some website about ladder line, and it was talking about how great ladder line was, and then it had an addendum from 2019 mentioning that eighth wave matching method. And I don't think it really takes, it's not going to give you 50 ohms, it's not going to give you 50 plus 0J, it's not going to do that, but it apparently does try to, it kind of moves the nodes and the anti-nodes out of the ham bands, so you won't be feeding into an anti-node and working against impedance like an infinity or something crazy like that. So it's not going to match it like a tuner would, but it's going to basically stop your tuner capacitor from arcing over, you know?
Lou recognized. Impedance of infinity, you're not going to get that. The highest impedance you'll ever get is an odd number of quarter wavelengths, which will give you an impedance inversion. If it's a 200-ohm ladder line and you feed 100 ohms of load to it, you'll get 400 ohms of on the other end. It'll change everything by a 2-to-1 ratio, but low on one end becomes high on the other end. It doesn't go to infinity. It just goes to a higher number in the worst case. Lou, NY2H, go right ahead. K2IW in the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Just checking Echolink. I heard Richie say he was having a problem with it. You know, sometimes it does go into a listen-only mode for some reason or other, and I could get in there and kick it. So I just kicked it, and I think we're good again, so that's all. Carry on. NY2H.
Very fine, Lou. Thank you for reinstalling the Echolink. Okay, we've taken more than enough time for the question and answer period. It's time to go over to Dr. Roy, who's got some darn interesting subjects to talk about tonight. I've seen his list. He doesn't have a puzzle tonight yet, but he's got some darn good subjects. AC2GS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Dick, can I ask you something?
Go ahead.
Okay, You said you know people that will do it for money, what I need done. It costs me $500, it's worth it. I need somebody to build a new desk, you know, put together furniture, put the equipment on it, run the cables, and put up the antenna. If you know somebody to do that for money, email me, Dick.
Okay. Yeah, the person I know is good at making antenna installations, but when it comes to the work on the desk that you're describing, I'm not sure that that's his specialty, but I'll see what I can find. Roy, AC2GS, go right ahead with Science Talk, K2IW and the TechNet.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. By the way, you had an extra person on your list, Rich W2BZ, I believe, had a question. And we actually have a question from the mailbag this afternoon.
Let me go back to BZ. Maybe I did skip him. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. Are you still there, sir? K2RIW on the TechNet.
I am indeed still here. I was just being a gentleman and let the flow continue. But I do have maybe not so much of a quick question, or maybe a very quick question. If, Dick, did you ever hear of a Palomar PT-3040? Not 3040, 340, a PT-340, which they call it a tuner. In other words, it sort of acts like a pre-tuner for your tuner. Are you familiar with that? It's an old piece of equipment. I just bought it on eBay for $29.
The price is right, Dick. I don't think I've heard of it. What, to your knowledge, is a pre-tuner tuner? The best tuner in the world is one that has very low loss, you know, great big beefy coils and beefy capacitors, and a wide tuning range. That's the best tuner in the world, which can take any impedance in and any impedance out and within reason match them. Why would you need a pre-tuner to a tuner? So if you got some words on that, give it to us, Dick. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2IW in the TechNet.
I'll just read a little bit here for a second. It says that the tuner is also for SWL. My application is using my ancient Merch Ultimate Transmatch with a Heath Most Accurate clock. The antenna, due to being in New York City apartment, is not the best, and a careful match is essential. However, the WWD signal fades in and out, making the tuner adjustments nearly impossible. The tuner, and that's what I just bought, the tuner solves the problem by letting me tune the makeshift antenna to optimally feed the clock to receive the 10 megahertz signal. No worry for me about accidentally transmitting into the Palomar, as the clock surely is not a transmitter. So, let me see. If it did allow me to achieve the best possible match, but there is no SWR, or is there, to measure, blah, blah, blah. Does any of the above make sense to you, Dick?
Not a great deal, Dick. Doesn't make a great deal of sense to me. I own one of these Radio Shack WWV radios, which has got a switch in the back where it'll listen to 2.5, 5, and 15, I think, megacycles. And depending on where the gray line is, if I listen to WWV at, say, for instance, 11 o'clock at night, at 2.5 megs, they're coming through gangbusters. At high noon, not a chance. You're getting a whole lot of D-layer absorption on the 2.5 megs. And when it comes to the 5 megs, it's just other times when I can hear it. So whether or not I hear WWV, it's primarily a function of what frequency I'm on and what time of day it is, and the fact they're in, I guess it's Boulder, Colorado. I got to get there by, I guess, maybe 2 bounces off the ionosphere. I want to make sure the ionosphere is there and not a lot of D-layer absorption. So I've got to choose the right frequency and the right time in order to listen to them. There are times when my guess is that signal from WWV is awfully weak or hard to listen to, depending on what you're using as an antenna and how directive it is. Give us some words on what's your favorite way of listening to National Bureau of Standards, or the NIST these days. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2IW in the TechNet.
You know, this sort of falls into, again, back to a question I asked a couple of months ago, which is, I have found it useful, but I may be getting a false reading on my Kenwood 440 SWR meter. I have found it useful to pre-tune with an MFJ tuner, a big tuner, physically a big tuner, to pre-tune my Kenwood 440 tuner, because without doing that, I can't get anything near a usable SWR. But if I adjust the MFJ tuner and then run the automatic tuner in the Kenwood 440, it goes down into resonance. Now, I don't know if I'm getting fooled or if I'm really doing, if I'm really helping out the Kenwood tuner by using the MFJ tuner in front of it.
In that case, I think you're helping. The way an automatic tuner works is it looks at the reflected signal, measures its amplitude and phase, does its internal calculation as to what impedance it's looking to, and starts adjusting its inductors and capacitors accordingly. An automatic tuner is looking at reflected signal, amplitude, and phase. There are certain key impedances that give you a particular amplitude or reflected phase where the automatic tuner gets confused, and it goes searching and never finds the solution. So in that particular case, your tuner on the outside is getting you out of one of those nasty impedances that the automatic tuner cannot handle. So in that case, your tuner is doing something very useful for you, I believe, Rich. W2BZ, K2IW.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. And I will be able to test that finally and for the first time with a new antenna tuner that I emailed back and forth with Dr. Roy about. It's Rig Experts AA30.0. And the difference between the AA30 and the AA30.0 is all you get with this is the circuit board that goes into the handheld device. However, if you pair that up with a UART serial USB cable and a 5-watt power supply and software that they have, which somebody else wrote, that was a whole other discussion last night, but somebody else wrote on GitHub, you have an antenna tuner for $77. And I think you guys know by now my proclivity for $77, $79 ham radios. So I will be able to report back on that circuit board. I saw a couple of videos that, you know, saving myself a couple hundred dollars maybe. Hopefully. We'll see. Back to you, W2RW, W2BZ.
Very fine there, Rich. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And yes, we amateurs like saving money. Even though we may have deep enough pockets to buy the fancy rig, to find an inexpensive way to get around it is a fun thing to do. Good luck with that project, and let us know how that works out. And once you understand the theory of operation, you should be in good shape. Many people believe that an antenna tuner takes the reflected signal from the antenna and throws it away. Absolutely not. When you finally adjust an antenna tuner correctly, it is taking that reflected signal that's giving you the standing wave ratio, re-reflecting it forward in phase with the signal that your transmitter is now producing. When you adjust with the best impedance match, you're automatically doing that. The average person doesn't know it. A well-constructed antenna tuner can run ice cold, dissipate no power, and all the reflected power gets reused, gets re-reflected forward. The only loss you get is the fact that the transmission line has got some signal bouncing back and forth a number of times before it finally gets radiated. You still get the extra loss of the transmission line, but the antenna tuner itself, in the ideal world, a well-made one with beefy components, can be theoretically lossless. And the transmitter itself can end up seeing what it thinks is a pure 50-ohm load, even though your antenna might be something that's really terrible. Okay, we're going to go over to Roy now. Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead with your science talk, Roy. We're ready.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dick. Once again,
If you have any questions or topics or suggestions or reputations, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all the topics that I'm going to cover, including one that Paul gave me to post, will be on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. So keep those two in mind, mailbag@ac2gs.com and the web link, roy.ac2gs.com. I'll break for a second, and then I will go on with the show. Okay, I hope all you guys find these discoveries about LIGO, the Laser Interferometry Gravitational Wave Observatory, as intriguing as I do, because there's always going to be stories about it, and I'm always going to talk about it. If there's a tagline for these days, there's an app for that. And in the case of LIGO detection, there actually are apps for that. Just search for a gravitational wave on your iPhone or your iPad or your Android phone, and you'll find a few of them. And if you don't like that, I've linked a page of a web browser where it gives bulletins of reports of LIGO findings. A pair of objects, each more massive than the sun, but only as wide as a city, have once again produced ripples in space-time that were picked up by sensitive gravitational wave detectors on Earth, but this time scientists think they may have measured something even weirder than usual. Let me drop for a second. After booting up a month ago for their third observing run, the Virgo and the two LIGO gravitational wave observatories have already measured five potential gravitational wave systems. These include three potential collisions between black holes, a pair of colliding neutron stars, and maybe even a neutron star colliding with a black hole. The LIGO and Virgo science collaborations are releasing their detections directly and publicly in the near real time so that astronomers around the world can immediately follow up with their own observations. Quote, we expect there will be much more insight into the laws of nature and the universe in this observing run to come and beyond, said Jess McIver, senior postdoctoral scholar in experimental physics at the LIGO Laboratory at Caltech in Pasadena. After the Nobel Prize-winning 2015 observation of gravitational waves from colliding black holes, the LIGO and Virgo experiments now routinely measure these gravitational disturbances the way that other telescopes might measure gamma-ray bursts. The ripples pass through LIGO and Virgo observatories, which split laser beams, send them down mile-plus-long pipes, and rejoin the beams on a detector. A gravitational wave would cause one of the laser paths to change, producing subatomic-sized interference patterns after the beams are reunited. Let me pause for a sec. Black hole collisions have become nearly routine, but neutron star collisions have produced a host of interesting science results, since they also come with a corresponding electromagnetic signal. The resulting explosion, called a kilonova, provides the energy required to produce many of the elements heavier than iron, even in our own solar system. These collisions also provide a way to measure how quickly the universe is expanding by comparing the wavelength of the resulting flash to the distance that the gravitational waves had to travel to arrive at Earth. LIGO and Virgo scientists measured evidence of a second neutron star collision on April 25th. But the detector had never spotted a black hole colliding with a neutron star until the next day, April 26th. This detection could be helpful in multiple ways. It's a first, so that's interesting on its own, but it can also help scientists explain where in the universe such pairs form, as well as the orientation of black holes as it spins compared to its binary partner. It would provide an even better way to measure the universe's expansion. Salvatore Vitale, assistant professor at the LIGO lab at MIT, said during a press conference, there's currently a discrepancy between the various ways that scientists measure how fast the universe is expanding, so any additional independent measurements would be a great help. Let me drop for a second. LIGO and Virgo announced detections mainly through something called the GCN circulars, which provide various pieces of evidence to astronomers around the world. including the approximate location of the source that produced the waves, the chance that the detector spotted a false alarm, and what might have produced the signal. But following up on all these signals have been and will continue to be a challenge, Berger said. At present, he felt that there is some potentially useful gravitational wave data missing from the GCN circulars, especially given how valuable telescope time can be. Quote, the more information we have, the more clarity we're going to have about which events to follow up on, he explained, that the April 26th event came with a relatively high chance that it was a false alarm. Let me drop for a second. Still, it's thrilling. It's a thrilling time for astrophysics. Neutron star collisions might come in each month, and black hole collisions even more frequently. From much farther out in the universe. More data will tell us more about these powerful events than ever before. For now, the gravitational wave detectors are more sensitive than ever and will be receiving further upgrades. At the end of this observing run in spring 2020, a Japanese detector called KAGRA will join the group then, too. While there are some growing pains and the usual issues that come with any large effort, worldwide collaboration between the different types of observatories is teaching scientists more about the universe than ever before. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2PS.
The very first detection that LIGO made that we are aware of, Roy, was a pair of black holes. I think one was 31, the other was 27, million solar masses. And they made a very brief chirp of a fraction of a second and then turned very quiet. And that's sort of because the black holes themselves won't allow any signal to get back out of there. The second detection was a pair of neutron stars, and that made a much louder, longer signal, and I think other telescopes for a number of days were hearing the signal of that collision, the pair of neutron stars. Now, when a neutron star hits a black hole, do you get a result that's some way halfway between those two extremes? AC2GS, K2IW.
Well, they haven't completely decided that it's truly the collision they were looking for, but it, to a degree, yes. The problem with black holes is since they swallow all the electromagnetic radiation that they locally generate, you don't really see much, so all you heard was the chirp, whereas the two neutron stars, when they collided, put on a fireworks display, gamma radiation, X-rays. A matter of fact, there was a big question at the time when I even reported it of what was the result of the two neutron star collisions. There was a big question of was it just another bigger neutron star or was it a black hole? And lately they've come to the conclusion that that the collision of the two neutron stars produced something slightly different. It's called a magnetar. It's basically a large, powerful neutron star with an incredibly stronger magnetic field. So it didn't turn into a black hole, just a bigger, nastier neutron star. But yeah, probably there'll be some intermediate because from the field where the neutron star is, that will give enough of a space to let radiation leak out the side. So that's what I'm assuming. But this is very early. The good thing is we learn about it immediately. The bad thing is we learn very little immediately, and it takes time to digest all the data.
I'm going to guess that a neutron star and a black hole gives you a longer lasting signal than you get from the pair of black holes. But still, in the case of two neutron stars, you still have probably a neutron star left over, a composite. But when a neutron star and a black hole combine, I'll bet you within a couple of seconds, the neutron star gets completely absorbed by the black hole, and after that, you're not going to hear very much. That's my guess, unless some of the neutron star ended up as rings around the black hole temporarily. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Well, that's another interesting question. As we talked about in the past, neutron stars are incredibly dense material. A teaspoon weighs the same as 100,000 tons, 100,000 tons. I forget the number, but it's a ridiculous concentration. Effectively, what gravity does is force all the electrons and protons together and binds them in as neutrons, and it's just one big puddle of neutrons with very little space. So chances are it probably envelops the black hole, envelops the neutron star, and in the case of the two neutron stars, leaving the magnetar there caused a lot of gamma and X-ray for days on end as the magnetar spun out its energy. In the case of a neutron and a neutron star and a black hole, you probably just get a blip, and then that's it. You're not going to get days worth of radiation from an event like that, I would imagine, unless they find that the gravitational force of a black hole is so great that it can actually rip apart the fabric of a neutron star, which will be interesting in and of itself.
KD2, KDG.
What's your comment?
I was going to say that even though the merger itself might not produce anything specifically, it's going to put out a lot for that little brief blip before it completely collapses. And considering that it's a supernova remnant, it's probably going to ionize all the surrounding gas and continue to radiate for several days. So even if they do pick it up on LIGO, they'd probably be able to see the just after effects and the aftershocks with optical telescopes and conventional stuff. Over.
They might. I guess, among other things, it has to do with the distance of the objects and the masses involved and the amount of ionization. When they had the episode with the two colliding black holes, there was a great deal of gravitational energy that was emitted, but not much in the way of actual electromagnetic radiation that was perceivable. So, you know, it's possible, but I guess there are other variables also that have an effect on that. Any other comments or questions or answers, or I'll go to the next story.
Roy, didn't the LIGO recently have another upgrade that increased its sensitivity by something like 10 to 1? So is it now at the maximum sensitivity since the last upgrade? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's been put online for only a little bit more than a month now, and it's reporting all kinds of interesting things. It's more sensitive than it was. They're planning to tweak it again in 2020, at which time they're going to add a Japanese interferometer along with the Italian and the American ones as well. So things hopefully will just be getting better and better as far as our detection. We'll be able to detect smaller black hole collisions and neutron star collisions and collisions farther and farther away from us.
So there's another whole chunk of astronomy going on here. We've had optical, infrared, ultraviolet, gamma ray astronomy. So now gravity wave astronomy and detecting how many, how far, what kind, and how strong. So as time goes on, we'll know more and more about the universe by looking at the collisions of these massive objects detected by these gravity wave astronomy detectors. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yes, Dick, it's an exciting time. I mean, when I did my first report on LIGO, it's a new way of detecting the universe around us, and among other things, it appears that we're going to be able to use it to make sense out of the Hubble constant. There are presently two major methods that we detect the Hubble constant. One is by assessing the microwave cosmic background, and the other is by looking at the SEPI'd variable stars. And the problem is the two different methods give you two different numbers. I think there's about a 10% difference between the two, and it's a very accurate 10% difference. So it'll be interesting to see a third method, what it does to the 10%. Hopefully it won't be another 10% in the opposite direction.
Mother Nature is stranger and stranger. You can't write this stuff, Roy.
Not at all, not at all. I mean, I keep going back to good old Richard Feynman's story. He said that if you think you know quantum mechanics, you don't know quantum mechanics. And probably the same thing goes to relativity as well. They are very non-intuitive aspects of our universe because we kind of live in the middle, in the macro range. We don't live in the cosmic range. We don't live in the subatomic range. So in the macro range, Isaac Newton laws work perfectly well. It's only in the minutia of subatomic particles and the cosmos that you throw those laws out the window. Okay, on to the next. We're familiar with the phrase caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, but apparently NASA has not learned this lesson yet. NASA has found its loss of two 92-foot Taurus rockets, as well as the climate monitoring satellites they were carrying in 2009 and 2011, were due to a supplier that falsified test data about frangible joints that were supposed to split and release the rocket's fairing. According to a NASA Launch Service Program report released on April 30th, agency engineers have determined that the Oregon aluminum extrusion manufacturer Sapa Profiles Incorporated had doctored fail test results, swapped out measurements from acceptable made batches, or altered the condition of testing to ensure favorable results. They then shipped out the poorly made parts to the clients, one of which was Orbital Science, the manufacturer of the Taurus rocket. As a result, NASA determined the clamshell-style nose cones of the rockets carrying the orbiting Carbon Observatory and GLORY satellites failed to fall on command due to the STI's faulty frangible joints surviving explosive charges. Let me drop for a sec. Both Taurus rockets then plummeted to their doom in the ocean, with NASA Launch Service Program writing in the report that the combined cost of both mission failures was in excess of $700 million. Quote, NASA relies on the integrity of our industry throughout the supply chain, end quote, NASA Director for Launch Services Jim Norman said in a separate statement. Quote, while we do perform our own testing, NASA is not able to retest every single component. That is why we require and pay for certain components to be tested and certified by the supplier. When testing results are altered and certifications are provided falsely, missions fail, end quote. NASA referred its findings to the NASA Office Inspector General and the Department of Justice, who determined that SBI was motivated by a desire to conceal its shoddy workmanship and incentivized the staff to help cover their tracks by offering production-based bonuses. According to a Department of Justice press release on April 23rd, SBI's parent company has agreed to a deal in which it would pay $46 million to NASA, the Department of Defense, and other entities to, quote, resolve criminal charges and civil claims related to a 19-year fraud scheme that included falsifying thousands of certifications for aluminum extrusion provided to hundreds of customers, end quote. Let me drop for a sec. NASA's statement also said that SPI and Norsk Hydro, its parent companies, have both been suspended from government contracting, and NASA has proposed both companies receive government-wide disbarment. The release of the report may have been motivated by the company's continued denial that it was at fault. The orbiting carbon observatory never went into service, but a replacement made it to space in 2014, and another successor is scheduled to launch in May. A GLORY did not receive a replacement. Well, you know, at least the $19 million toilets that NASA bought for the International Space Station back in 2007 actually worked. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I know NASA hasn't given up with those frangible joints. They worked on that extensively. They plan on using it on the SLS, the Space Launch System. But apparently, this company was unable to successfully You're actually detonating this strip of metal, you know, from one, you know, completely around the whole, either the whole circumference or, in this case, the bearings themselves to separate. Apparently, that didn't work. Maybe the metal was too strong for the, you know, when these detonations go off. It's supposed to expand the metal and then the pieces separate. I guess that didn't happen.
Yes, that's my understanding, Paul. It's kind of inverse logic. You would think that if a piece of equipment is faulty, it's liable to break. Its faultiness was that it was structurally stronger than it was supposed to be.
KD2, KDG.
KDG.
I actually saw a video on this topic. Apparently, it was too weak, and the reason it didn't break is because the dead core that they use on the joint to break it actually relies on the metal, the material being strong enough to, like, brittly snap and just kind of snap off. But because it was weak, it just kind of deformed instead of actually snapping. So it never fully released, and that was the problem they had with it. So it was actually too weak, but it just, the whole way they separate these is very precise, and just being off a little bit completely wrecked the whole system.
Hey, thanks, Paul. Makes a lot of sense to me, because usually when people foul up with things, they tend to be structurally weaker than stronger. So it makes sense that instead of a nice, clean snap, it probably just kind of curled, and that wasn't enough to accomplish what it was designed to do.
Okay, and that was another station that gave that information about the weakness of the aluminum.
Paul, KD2, KDG.
Paul, okay, Paul, part two. Understood. Thank you, Roy.
Serious economy that they caused the loss of $700 million to NASA and government, and but they're being charged pennies on the dollar. Oh, well, our government in action. Anyway, on to the next. As of last week, there have been 695 cases of measles in the United States across more than 20 states this year, the highest annual toll seen since the disease was declared extinguished in the United States in the year 2000, according to the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. Given that it's only April, and we've already broken a yearly record, it looks like things may get worse before they get better. Measles is a highly contagious virus, capable of infecting someone through airborne droplets left behind by someone else, even hours after they're no longer present. But measles' one major weakness is humanity itself. Humans are the only natural host for this virus. It uses to reproduce and spread. That means that if you can fully stop the chain of transmission between people by vaccinating practically everyone who could be exposed to it, for instance, you could theoretically eradicate measles completely and totally. In the United States, the eradication of measles was formally declared in 2000 thanks to a tremendous public health effort and a mandatory vaccination program. But since there are still parts of the world where measles happens regularly, even with vaccination, travelers have continued to catch measles somewhere else and bring it back to the United States. Now, because most Americans continue to be vaccinated against it at an early age, outbreaks and cases of measles since 2000 have largely been isolated. The anti-vaccination movement, however, has provided the kindling for this resurgence in measles, according to Peter Pitts, a former associate commissioner for external relations at the Food and Drug Administration and president and co-founder of the Center of Medicine in the Public Interest. Let me drop for a second. In some of the largest outbreaks seen this year in New York, for instance, the trouble started when unvaccinated residents returned from travel to Israel, a country dealing with its own major measles epidemic, and then spread it among the pockets of unvaccinated residents in their communities. In 2018, which saw more than 300 cases across the country, 82 cases were traced to travelers alone, the highest number seen since the year 2000. But it isn't just the very young or willfully unvaccinated that have to worry about measles. Even people who dutifully get the recommended two dosages of MMR vaccine are not completely immune to the measles, and its immunity wanes to some extent over time. People before the 1990s who were only given one dose as a child have a higher risk still. Normally, this wouldn't matter much since measles is so rare, but the more pockets of transmission there are, the more chances of our immunity has to fail. And while measles is usually a flu-like, relatively mild disease, it can sometimes cause much more serious complications and even death. Thankfully, no one in the United States has died from measles yet this year. Let me drop for a sec. Vaccines only work when everyone's vaccinated, something we call the herd effect. And when one member of the herd isn't vaccinated, it puts everyone at risk, especially those who haven't been vaccinated yet, like young children. Affected cities and states have scrambled to contain these outbreaks, with some, like New York City, now mandating that the unvaccinated people in the area get the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine under the threat of a hefty fine. Other areas, with some legal challenges, have tried to bar infected or unvaccinated people from public spaces. These efforts to stop the outbreak may very well work. Just this week, Clark County, Washington, the epicenter of the state's cases, declared its outbreak over after 42 days of no new cases. But there are ongoing outbreaks in four other states, California, Michigan, New Jersey, and good old New York, and the conditions are still ripe for an escalation. When a measles outbreak happens, it only gets progressively worse. It's not necessarily going to burn itself out because there's always a continuously renewable source of non-vaccinated children. If communities in New York, for instance, don't aggressively get people vaccinated, it will grow and grow exponentially, especially since these are urban communities that live in close proximity to one another and others. The good news is that overall, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination rates remain high, according to the CDC. In New York, for instance, more than 97% of kindergartners were vaccinated as of 2017. And even the worst-performing states, Colorado, Idaho, and Washington, still have nearly 90% vaccination rates. So the odds of going back to the pre-vaccination days, of seeing millions of kids come down with measles annually, are slim to none at this point. Let me drop for a sec. But there's a real chance, as the CDC admits, that if enough people continue to avoid the vaccine, measles can reemerge as a local threat to the country again. Meanwhile, the growing number of cases elsewhere in Europe and the world are derailing efforts to wholly eradicate the disease and will surely create more opportunities for these brush fire of measles to keep popping up stateside. If you don't aggressively vaccinate against these diseases, they will win. Mother Nature will win, one of the researchers said, and that's something that's easy to forget when you've been off the radar for so long. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX.
Will you be to GXM?
Yes, Rich.
AC2GS, this is WB2GXM. I would like to know, are measles vaccinations given by drugstores similar to flu shots? Let me know.
At this point, I don't believe they do. It's routine to get an annual booster to your flu shot. It is not routine to get measles, mumps, rubella boosters. Usually, unless a person has a strong history of not having been vaccinated, it tends to result in blood tests to see how immune you are to it before you get a booster shot.
Okay, thank you, Roy. I mean, I'm asking because currently I do not have a doctor for whatever reason. Guess I got to get to one. ACTGS, WB2GXM.
WS to unquestion.
False.
According to CBS Radio, I was listening the other day, and they were talking about the measles. They said that some people might not remember if they ever had a shot when they were younger, or whether or not they had the measles, or they thought they did, or Well, whatever it is, if it's vague in your head, you could go to a doctor, according to CBS, and get a blood test, and the blood test would tell you if you're immune to the measles or not. And if you're not, you could get the shot. Have you heard that, Roy? Back to you.
Yes, Paul. That's the sort of what I said before. You do a titers for dilution of antibodies, and by the results you can tell if you have immunity, strong immunity, weak immunity. You can kind of figure out the results and act accordingly. So if you have doubts personally about whether or not you were vaccinated or whether or not you had childhood cases of measles, you can go to your doctor and tell them that, and they'll just draw your titers, and in a week or so, when you come back, if they're low, sufficiently low, he'll give you a booster. If they're reasonably high, you don't need it.
Okay, very, very good, Roy. Didn't know what the title was, but I guess that has something to do with the blood. Back to you, Roy.
VDH with a question. Yes, John, one second. Titers is just a dilution. So in other words, these things test to see if antibodies cause clotting. So you do 1 to 1, you do 1 to 2, 1 to 4, 1 to 8, 1 to 16, 1 to 32, and you keep kind of having it to see what kind of a dilution will still produce the same antibody reaction. And that gives you a good idea of not only whether you have antibodies, but how strong, how concentrated they are. But, John, you wanted to ask something.
Yeah, question about the effectiveness of actually having had the measles. I know I've had the measles, it was back in the late 50s. I remember the summer I was out at Sag Harbor. So I know I had the measles. How effective is actually having the measles versus the having the vaccination? Go ahead.
Well, it's probably having the measles is better than a single measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. They shifted to a double dose that are probably just as effective as having the actual infection. But the problem, among other things, is as we get older, our immune status kind of drifts, and we're not quite as immune as we once were. But approximately out of people who've been either properly vaccinated or had the infection, the infection rate of the measles is only 5%. So if you keep the herd level down with vaccinations and such, you won't be exposed enough to live measles to kind of reach that 5% unusual rate. I mean, just because I was vaccinated or you had measles doesn't mean that you're completely safe. There's always that 5% chance, but it's a lot better than if you didn't have a vaccination or a previous infection.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Okay, on to the next. An international collaboration between several universities around the world has led to an innovation in light-emitting diodes that could potentially result in a giant leap forward when it comes to increasing the resolution on television screens and mobile devices. For the first time ever, a single light-emitting diode can now change color all by itself. The current design and chemical makeup of light-emitting diodes limits the technology to producing light in just one single color. So-called multicolor light-emitting diodes actually rely on a cluster of light-emitting diodes inside that each produce either red, green, or blue. When their individual intensities are adjusted, the colors that each light produces mix to produce an overall shade of light. LED blacklit LCDs work in a similar fashion, but to produce one colored pixel, three filtered LEDs are required. Even the next big breakthrough in flat-screen TV technology, micro light-emitting diodes, requires a trio of ultra-tiny light-producing diodes to create a single pixel, which limits how many can be squeezed into a given area and resolution. In a paper recently published in the ACS Photonics Journal, researchers from Lehigh University and Westchester University in Pennsylvania, Osaka University in Japan, and the University of Amsterdam
detail a new approach to making LEDs that uses a rare earth ion called europium, and when paired with gallium nitride, an alternative to silicon, allows the LED's color to be adjusted on the fly. The secret sauce is how power is used to excite the europium and gallium nitride. Different ratios and intensities of current apparently can selectively produce the emissions of three primary colors, red, green, and blue. Let me drop for a second. Using this approach, light-emitting diode light bulbs with specific color temperatures could be produced and sold at much cheaper price points, since the colors from the multiple tint-specific LEDs don't have to be mixed. The technology could yield similar benefits for TVs and screens that end up in the mobile devices. Instead of three light-emitting diodes, red, green, and blue, needed to generate each pixel, a single europium-based light-emitting diode could do the job. Even more exciting than cheaper price tags is the fact that replacing three LEDs with just one could result in displays with three times the resolution. Your eyes probably wouldn't be able to discern that many pixels on a smartphone screen, but in smaller displays like those used in viewfinders of digital cameras, a significant step up in resolution could be a noticeable improvement. So, anyone for a 16K TV display? Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GF.
VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
Would they be able to have the LEDs for each color on at the same time to provide mixing to get the various hues? Go ahead.
Well, since it's a single element, my guess is they're going to multiplex in time. So in other words, since we don't perceive, you can blink red, green, blue, and within our perception that's not seeing a blink, and we'll just merge the three colors together. So I'm assuming there's some pulse code modulation trick going on.
Oh, so they would have to essentially, scan at three times the actual physical scanning rate to have a time when the red, when the green, and when the blue is addressed so that... and fast enough so that your eye could mix them together, I take it.
Yeah, that's the way that I'm reading it. I mean, obviously they don't get into the nitty-gritty details because they're probably patenting every little bit and piece of this, but that's what it sounds like is going on. So there'll be some problems with timing, but, depending upon how things work... scan rates usually improve over time, thankfully, to the inventions and the research into solid-state, components and such. So that probably won't be an issue if and when this thing ever comes into production.
That's interesting. I think I remember in the early days of color TV, one of the systems that was proposed was to transmit the red, then the green, then the blue video separately and have them mix. It looks like we're back to something along that order. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, research is strewn with good ideas that never panned out for a bunch of different reasons. Probably back in those bad old days, scanning at that rate would kind of push the edge of engineering, so that might have been what was stopping them. But I couldn't even imagine how would you then multiplex red, green, and blue in the old phosphors, because there's no real way of doing that other than directing them at different places, and then there's nothing that I can think of being served by multiplexing them in time domain.
Well, the NTSC system, the old one, they had the essentially I and Q. They had the red minus luminance, and then I think it was blue minus luminance, and then the luminance signal. So they had their three channels. They just broke it up to maintain compatibility with black and white. Yeah, but as I see it, the underlying problem with using using time domain trickery is that in the end you still need the red, green, and blue phosphors on the screen. So there's not much you can do about that, at least with CRT terminals and the technology that was used at the time. As I said, I think I remember.